singer here, Israel. Israel National Radio. We were, before the news break, we were talking about folks who are willing to compromise what they know to be true in order to have the good life, and those who are unwilling to compromise on their ideals. Here's a man who is willing to give it up for what he knew to be true. Professor Francisco Gil White joining us now here on Israel National Radio. Don't touch the dial. All right. Singer here, Israel National Radio, and I'm going to be with you for, what, we have another two segments. My guest is a man who joined us during the summer when all hell was breaking loose at the University of Pennsylvania, where he was a professor of something to do with anthropology. I can't even pronounce the whole deal. And his name, Francisco Gil White, and he is joining us now here on Israel National Radio. Francisco, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Toby. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you on. I need to ask you this question, because I think this question is on the minds of folks who have watched, observed, and followed your career. You were set. You had a PhD from UCLA. You were teaching at one of the finest universities in America, Ivy League, University of Pennsylvania. Your career was set. You were fine. Why did you have to put your whole career in jeopardy, come out, express support for the Jewish state in a leftist university? You could have kept your mouth shut, hung on to a terrific job, and you would have been set. Why do you need to stand up for the Jews?
Well, the way you put it is not actually the way it happened. When I first started doing research on the Arab-Israeli conflict, I had no clue that I was going to get in trouble. I was very surprised, because the thing that really got me in trouble was an article that documented the history of the PLO. And in this article, I document that the man who created al-Fatah, which is the controlling core of the PLO, was Haj Amin al-Husseini. And that Haj Amin al-Husseini had been the Mufti of Jerusalem in the first half of the 20th century and had organized massive terrorist riots against innocent Jews in British Mandate Palestine. And when the World War exploded, Haj Amin al-Husseini he went to Berlin, met with Hitler in 1941, late 1941, and then became the top co-architect of the German Nazi Final Solution together with Adolf Eichmann. So this is a man responsible for exterminating the European Jewish population. And after the war, he mentored Yasser Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas and helped them create al-Fatah, which swallowed the PLO around 69-70 and kept the name. But the PLO is essentially this organization, al-Fatah, created by the top co-architect of the German Nazi Final Solution. So when I wrote this piece, I didn't expect that people would attack me for presenting a set of historical facts, which is what a social scientist is supposed to do.
And your specialty, I want to make sure I've got this clear, you're an anthropologist, and your
area of specialty is
anthropology, but you're a student of ethnic conflict, which must make what's going on in the Middle East fascinating. Is that specialty, that background that you have, did that enable you, arm you to be able to research this subject properly?
Yeah, well, I mean, ethnic conflict is the thing I became a social scientist to study. And when I was hired at the University of Pennsylvania, I was not yet a student of the Arab-Israeli conflict. My PhD thesis was an attempt to explain why the human mind is so susceptible to racist ideas. I wanted to understand what is it about the normal patterns of thought of the human species that make it so easy to seduce people into becoming racist of one sort or another. So it was a general approach to understanding certain aspects of human social psychology that have to do with the development of ethnic prejudice that then underlies ethnic conflict. But I hadn't yet, when I was hired at the University of Pennsylvania, begun any particular study of a specific conflict. But when I did start studying the Arab-Israeli conflict and the civil wars in Yugoslavia, and began producing documentation that contradicted the NATO claims about what was going on and the claims that one usually hears in the mainstream mass media, to my surprise, I found that my superiors at the University of Pennsylvania didn't want me doing this. And eventually, I started getting threats. By the way, they agreed with me that my documentation was impeccable, because I asked them to point out if I had gotten anything wrong. And they said, no, this is impeccable. And as if we were in the mafia, they told me that if I continued doing this kind of work, I would lose my job. And I eventually did, because although I hadn't looked for this fight, once I got it, I decided that I would not stop telling the truth just because somebody is an anti-Semite, as the people above me obviously were.
And I want to just make this clear. It's not like you're some Jewish guy who had been this advocate for Israel all of your adult life, some pro-Israel guy running around trying to then affect the folks who are around you. You weren't even into this whole thing, and my guess is before you started researching it, and correct me if I'm wrong, you probably thought that you were probably more pro-Palestinian than after you started studying the subject. Is that correct?
Yes, this is true. Before I started doing any work on the Arab-Israeli conflict, I was consuming, like everybody else, the standard story that one hears on CNN and that one reads in the New York Times. And my view of the conflict was that view. I had absorbed the representation of the Israelis as an imperialist power, oppressing third world people, taking away their land, making their lives difficult, and so on and so forth. I really didn't know anything about it because I had not studied that conflict in particular. And once I did study it, to my amazement, I found that everything that the mass media was saying was upside down.
If you are just tuning in, my guest, Dr. Francisco Gil Wright, who was until this summer professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and incidentally, so the listeners know this, I don't know the exact percentage, but the University of Pennsylvania has to be something like 35% or 40% Jewish, and I'm just putting that in as a footnote. Do with that information what you wish. He has a website that I want you to know because it is a wealth. It is a library of information about the history of Israel, what has happened to him at the University of Pennsylvania, but what has gone on in the Middle East in this remarkable conflict. The website address is hirhome.com. That's hirhome.com. And what that stands for is historical and investigative research. Okay, home.com, a very powerful site. And I'm going to ask you this question because I need you to be my professor for a moment. After all, you, and I'm saying it, I'm saying in front of you, you didn't just, you know, you're not some guy who got a, who went to, I don't know, Queens College. You did really well. You won awards for your studies in, and you have studied ethnic conflict, and your purpose is to understand why people hurt each other, why people hate each other, and how do different communities get turned against each other. So here you are, you have spent a considerable amount of time studying the conflict and the hatred that's ingrained in the Arab world against the Jewish people, and now you have your entire audience from the entire land of Israel, in Europe, the United States, throughout the world, listening to you. Why do they hate us?
Trying to make me nervous, Tovia?
I ask you the truth. We all want to know the truth. Why the hell do they hate us so much? Why isn't Israel isn't loved by all the left? Why isn't Israel loved by the Arab world? In the Arab world, Arabs are persecuted. They can't share in the wealth. Women have no rights. In Israel, Arabs can do what they want. Why the hell do they hate us so much, Mr. Know-It-All? I'm just kidding, but what I'm saying is, you're so smart, you study this, so what's the answer in the Middle East?
This is a question I get more and more. People want to know what's the reason for anti-Semitism. This is a question that began to bother me once I started showing that everything that was being said about the Arab-Israeli conflict was upside down. Because the more I studied the Arab-Israeli conflict and the more I learned about the history of the Jews, the more I convince myself that Jewish culture is actually very nice. And the more I read the Torah and the other Jewish books, and the more I studied the history of the Jewish people, which I began studying from the very beginning, the more I convince myself that Judaism is a civilization organized around ethics and compassion and the protection of ordinary people. So once this dawned on me, the question, why do people hate the Jews, really started to nag me. And it's really an interesting question because when you look at the long sweep of history, what we find is that anti-Jewish genocides are the most stable, recurrent process in Western history and in Muslim history. In the West, there have been great anti-Jewish genocides in the ancient Greco-Roman world, then in the feudal world of the Middle Ages, and also in the modern world of industrialized modern states. So, in spite of great technological, cultural, political, and religious transformations, people go on killing Jews. There is a mass killing of Jews almost every century in the West. So the safest prediction that a historian can make with his eyes closed, without even doing all the research I've been doing, is that there's going to be another one in the 21st. And I think very soon. Now the question is why? When I started studying ancient Judaism, I found something very interesting. In the Mediterranean, in the ancient Mediterranean, the dominant power was the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire had a system that was very similar in almost every detail, except for the obvious technological differences, to the Third Reich of the German Nazis. The Romans were running a vast police state where oceans of slaves would do all the work for the Roman aristocracy. Just to give you a sense for this, in Italy, slightly more than half of the population that lived there was formally enslaved. And then there were lots of informal slaves who were technically free, but in reality were living in a different kind of slavery. These people were brutalized daily because the Romans were not merely oppressive, they were sadistic. So, as we know, because it's very famous, for Sunday entertainment, these people would have innocent people fight each other to death as if we were at a cockfight. And even more incredible, they would have sometimes innocent people just be fed alive to African beasts. So this was a pathological society, much like the German Reich in many, many different ways. They also had death camps, which were the Roman mines, where multitudes of slaves were simply worked to death. Now, in this ancient Roman Mediterranean, the Jews were incredibly popular. They were spread all over the Mediterranean, and they were converting the pagans at a feverish rate. Now, why were so many pagans converting to Judaism? Well, it's a little bit obvious once you understand Jewish law. Jewish law is based traditionally on the story of a slave revolt against an oppressive Egyptian king. Jewish law is born in a successful revolution. And after that revolution, the leader of the movement, Moses, enacts a series of laws that are designed with great care to protect ordinary workers from ever being oppressed again. So the masses of the Mediterranean could see that the Jewish movement was the compassionate and ethical alternative to the oppressive and sadistic Roman Empire, and the pagans were converting very quickly to the Jewish movement. So many that by the first century, according to the lower estimate of most historians, 10% of the Roman Empire was already Jewish. And an even bigger population was called God-fearers by the Jews, and these were people who hadn't yet converted, but who were very attracted to Jewish law and would go to the synagogues on the Sabbath and would begin adopting the Jewish laws and practices and were politically allied with the Jews. So the Jewish movement had something like 25 to 30% of the Mediterranean. The Romans were scared to death because this meant that if the Jewish movement kept growing, it was going to destroy the Roman Empire. Now, what happened? The Romans decided to give their Jewish problem a final solution. So, in the first and second centuries, they carried out a genocide of the Jewish people that, in proportional terms, is even greater than what Hitler did in Europe in the 20th century. The most famous events of this great genocide, which lasted about 135 years, are known as the First Jewish War and the Second Jewish War, which ended with the Bar Kokhba Revolt in the second century, about around the year 135 of the Christian era. So, once this context is understood, I think it's very clear why there's anti-Semitism. The ruling elite in the West have inherited an ideology going all the way back to the Greco-Romans, which is an ideology to oppress ordinary people. And in order to achieve the oppression of ordinary people, you have to get rid of the Jewish movement. In order to do that, you need to poison the minds of ordinary people against the Jews so they won't discover Jewish law. And this is why, throughout the history of the West, the ruling elites have spent enormous sums of money mobilizing anti-Semitism so that ordinary people will grow up learning to hate the Jews and not be able to liberate themselves.
When
it's a long answer,
Rome,
but I think it's a necessary answer to really understand the problem.
I'm hanging on every word. I'm going to pick your brain because that's what I want to do. I want to give the website again, hirhome.com. My guest, Professor Francisco Gilwhite, here at Israel National Radio. And what I want to do, we only have a few seconds left, but what I want to do, and can I keep you on after the news break and commercials? Is that, do you have the time to do that?
Sure, I'll be very happy to stay.
Because what I'm trying to do here is get a freebie, meaning I want you to teach a class for free right here on Israel National Radio, meaning I want to understand it. And here's what I want to ask you when we come back after the news break is this, Professor. When Constantine, following his mother, would convert to Christianity, and the Catholic Church would become, or the Church would become the official religion of Rome, does this hatred of the Jew intensify and the portrayal of the Jew by the church fathers, and eventually that would continue throughout church history, and the reformers, seems they continued to perpetrate this demonic portrayal of the Jews. Did this portrayal ultimately was responsible for the unending cycle of violence against the children of Israel? And that's what I want to ask you when I come back after the news break, okay? Because this is a very big issue, I think, for many of the listeners, is what role did not, and when I ask this, I know there are many Christians who are Christian Zionists. We're not talking about you. We're talking about the Roman Catholic Church. We're talking about the Vatican. We're talking about the Church Fathers. We're talking about Luther, and I don't mean Martin Luther King. We're talking about these individuals. Did they essentially take the anti-Semitism that already was ensconced in Rome and magnify it, and therefore make these atrocities that such as the Holocaust make it possible? My guest, Francisco Gil White, former professor at the University of Pennsylvania, website address hirhome.com. When we come back after Newsbreak, Professor, I'm going to ask you to answer that question. Nobody touched the dial. Singer here, Israel National Radio. My guest, former professor, University of Pennsylvania, Francisco Gil White. And the reason I'm playing this music is because it goes to the question that I will present to him now. All right, we are back. Singer here, Israel National Radio. Professor Francisco Gil White, a former professor, University of Pennsylvania website. You must know this website. In fact, I'm going to ask those in the chat rooms to put this website up so folks in the chat rooms who are listening to the show study this so they can. It's hirhome.com. Francisco, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, great having you on. Before we, and let me just say this, the reason I'm going in this direction is really because I want to listen, I want to learn from you. And I could sit, and your website is, you know, just a wealth of information on the history of the Arab-Jewish conflict, and that's what it is. And there's just fabulous information there. I encourage listeners to go there. But I really just want to learn from you. When Rome becomes Christian, Constantine, following his mother, converts, and there is an explosion of anti-Semitism that pours out of that church, and it will continue consistently until recently, when you have this explosion of Christian Zionism, of premillennial dispensationalism that just is basically a little more than a century old. Did the church inflame the hatred of the Jew further?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing that needs to be understood is why the Roman aristocracy adopted the Christian religion. Because, as you were saying, Constantine converted, and under Constantine, the Catholic Church became the state church. And by force of arms, Constantine and the later emperors began forcing everybody in the Mediterranean to become Catholic. So the question is, why? And if you look at the Christian scriptures, the answer is not far to seek. In the letter to the Romans, Paul of Tarsus, the founder of the movement, Paul of Tarsus is known as St. Paul to Christians, and his letters are the very first Christian documents. They're earlier than the Gospels, and they're about 25% of the New Testament, 25-30%. They're a big chunk, and they're very important. In the letter to the Romans, Paul tells his followers that they should obey the Roman authorities because they are divinely ordained, and that those who disobey the Romans will be judged. Point one. In the letter to the Ephesians, Paul tells his followers that the slaves should not complain and they should obey their masters blindly, even when their masters are not watching. Point two. So this is an ideology that was quite convenient to the Roman Empire. It said that everybody should obey the Romans, and it told the slaves not to complain. Once the Roman aristocracy, and in particular the emperor, digested the point that the Christians couldn't honor him as divine, him personally, then the door was opened for them to adopt this ideology, which was quite convenient, especially once Christianity started spreading all over the Mediterranean. Now, it is important also to I forgot to mention one very important point. In the letter to the Galatians, Paul tells his followers that if they follow Jewish law, they will go to hell. And of course, Jewish law was precisely the thing that was threatening the political structure of the Roman Empire, because Jewish law is designed to liberate oppressed workers. So, in many ways, this was a very convenient ideology for the Romans. Now, what else was convenient? The Gospels say that the Jews, although the Gospels recognize that the Romans are the ones who directly crucified Jesus, they still managed to blame the Jews for this. If you study the history of the first century, it is obvious that this is a complete slander. Why? Because in the Gospel story, even if you accept it as historical truth, what the Gospel story says is that Jesus was arrested by the temple authorities. Now, in the first century, the temple was no longer really a Jewish institution. After Pompey, in the first century before Jesus, conquered Jerusalem, the temple in Jerusalem was purged by the Romans. What does this mean? It means that the Romans murdered any priest in the temple who didn't want to cooperate with the Roman occupation, and left only those priests who would corrupt themselves to help the Romans oppress the Jews. And the Romans themselves would appoint and remove the high priest of the Jerusalem temple. So in the first century, the temple was really a Roman institution. And in fact, the Gospels say that Jesus was arrested for creating a disturbance in the temple, which suggests that Jesus was probably, the historical Jesus, was probably a Jewish revolutionary trying to find a way to fight the Romans, and because he was fighting the Romans, he was against the temple. Now, since it was the temple authorities that arrested Jesus, what this means is it was the Romans who arrested Jesus. The whole thing was a Roman affair. Jews had nothing to do with it. And the representation of the Jews asking the Romans to crucify Jesus, that has to be invented, because it's like saying that during the Holocaust, you had a bunch of Jews who were also being persecuted by the Nazis, begging the Nazis to take this one controversial rabbi to Auschwitz. Now, does that make any sense? It doesn't make sense in the World War II, and the same structure doesn't make sense in the first century either. So, once this whole ideology was adopted by the aristocracy of the Roman Empire, we see a very interesting pattern. Of course, as we were saying earlier, the Greco-Romans were already anti-Semitic, and they carried out a horrific genocide of the Jewish people in the first and second century. Now, once the Catholic Church becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire, there were Jewish persecutions and so on, but there was... It wasn't as dramatic as it had been before, because there were now very few Jews left. And a couple centuries later, the political structure of the Roman Empire collapses, and German tribes conquer all of Western and Central Europe. the Catholic Church, which had become an empire within the empire, it was an enormous bureaucracy organized after the structure of the Roman army, and it had multitudes of slaves. This enormous bureaucracy that was the Catholic Church managed to survive the collapse of the political structure of the Latin Empire. Why? Because the German tribes, the German military aristocracies that conquered all of Western Europe began to realize that there was not, it didn't make a whole lot of sense to fight the Catholic Church. So one by one, the German kings converted to Catholicism and then forced all of their subjects by force of arms to convert, and were thus able to use this vast system of control, of ideological control, that the Romans had perfected in order to advance their own rule. Once this process matured sufficiently, the Vatican, in alliance with these German aristocracies, recreated the Roman Empire. And this was called the Holy Roman Empire of the Middle Ages, the Germanic Holy Roman Empire, which was an alliance between the Vatican and the German aristocracies that had become the rulers all over Europe. As soon as the Roman Empire was revived as the Holy Roman Empire, mass killings of Jews resumed. And the entire Middle Ages, for about 500 years, was one great mass killing of Jews after another, peppered also with expulsions and forced conversions, until the Jews were completely wiped out, almost, of Western Europe, and then that's why Hitler's genocide was mostly a genocide of Jews who were in Eastern Europe, because that's where 90% of the European Jews were, because the Jews in Western Europe had been exterminated in the Middle Ages.
Wow. The reason I respond so slowly is that I'm sitting here just holding my mouth. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Francisco Gil White, website HIRhome.com. And you know what I'll do is if callers have questions, we only have a few minutes left, I'll welcome those. So for my guest or myself, number 1-800-270-4288. You know, and as you're speaking, I'm just thinking that, you know, in fact, there was this great hunger and affection for the Jewish faith going back in the first century, and I'm just thinking of Galatians where Paul says, who's vexed you, why are you so interested in keeping the laws, and so on and so forth, but this would evolve very quickly. Is it correct that in order to cause people to persecute another, not just, but on a real personal level, you have to demonize those people. You have to portray them as subhuman, and that's what the Vatican had done. And although even today Rome is trying to distance itself from its anti-Semitic background, probably largely thanks to Pope John the 23rd, who had an important impact on the way the Catholic Church portrayed the Jews, but they still are pro-PLO. They still can't distance themselves completely from the anti-Semitism that once drove them. Is that accurate?
I would say that it is. I don't think the ideology of the Catholic Church has changed one little bit. I think it is possible that John the 23rd was a good man and truly wanted to take the Catholic Church in a new direction. I've seen a lot of evidence to suggest that this is true, but I think it was a great exception. And because I've also been studying the history of the popes, and I really don't think that the Catholic Church as a whole, and in particular the last two popes, are any different from the popes of the past.
Question. It appears to me that the anti-Semitism that is today so ensconced in the Arab world, Or I'll go beyond that, in the Islamic world, because it seems it's all the same deal. What's coming out of Malaysia, what's coming out of Indonesia, is basically the same stuff coming out of Syria. There's no significant difference, at least from the people who are speaking. It could be that if you go into the jungles of Indonesia, the local people there don't have that. But it's basically the anti-Semitism in the Arab world today is not a new, it wasn't created by the Arabs, it was borrowed from Christendom, from the church. It's essentially plagiarized portrayal of the Jew as demonic, as satanic, as subhuman. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I mean, there was some borrowing, and in fact, historian Bat Yor document that the legal structure to oppress the Jews in the Muslim world was in fact borrowed from the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, when the Muslims overran it. They basically adopted lock, stock, and barrel the entire system of laws that had been used in the Eastern Roman Empire to oppress the Jews. But there is also a homegrown anti-Semitism that is particular to the Islamic world that has to do with the preachings of Muhammad. So yes, there was some borrowing, but there's also much that was its own innovation.
It seems to me that, and I want to phrase these questions properly, that we are never going to save the West, freedom, liberty. We're not going to save Israel by deluding ourselves into believing that we could go to the Islamic world and change their thinking, that this is their thinking, their teaching of contempt is ensconced in their religious system, as you pointed out. And it's not like communist Russia where you can get rid of communism and new ideas. You're not going to change their religious system, and therefore the only way for Israel to protect itself, it is not going to be able to convert the Arab world into a bunch of Zionists, as seeing Jews as equals, but the only way is to really to defend ourselves and not compromise our land and think that we can appease the enemy and therefore save the Middle East. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, I would agree with you, Tovia. I think that part of the problem, part of the reason that there are so many people trying to get the Israelis, and this includes lots of Jews, to negotiate with their Muslim enemies, is that there's a very profound ignorance of what Islam is. And the reason is that what people have in their heads, a model of religion that is a modern model, which is a product of the European Enlightenment. And the European Enlightenment introduced ideas into Europe about freedom of religion, freedom of thought, tolerance of difference of opinion, and so on and so forth. And so now Westerners find it very natural that there are a whole big menu of different religions, and that, you know, people should worship whoever they want, and people should not meddle with each other and live and let live, except for anti-Semitism, because people continue to be anti-Semites. But outside of that, people are fairly tolerant and allow that there are many different beliefs and they should all be allowed to coexist simultaneously. This is not how the Muslims think. The central concept in Islam is jihad. Today there's a lot of propaganda about the word jihad. And in the mass media, Muslims are quoted left and right saying that jihad really has a spiritual meaning, and it's about the internal quest of, you know, defeating your own demons,
yeah,
and so on and so
nonsense.
Forth.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to find this concept in the Muslim literature. Right. I have an article on the front page of my website, HIR, where I trace the across the ages the opinions of Muslim clerics and scholars of what jihad is about and just how central it is to the organization of Islam. And what they say is that jihad is the central purpose of Islam. And they don't really have a spiritual interpretation for it, What they say is the jihad is the armed conflict against non-believers. And the point is to convert the entire planet to Islam, and whoever doesn't want to convert should be killed. This is not radical Islam. This is what people are told these days. They are told that this is fundamentalist Islam, that this is Islamism, Islamofascism, fundamentalist Islam, and so forth. That's not true. This is Orthodox Islam. This is the standard central ideology of a normal Muslim. Now, that is not to say that Muslims who want to get along with non-Muslims don't exist. They do.
I know both of them.
In the ideology of Islam, these people are heretics.
Exactly.
And they are in a very fragile position because it is very easy to preach against them because the holy book of Islam, the Quran, does not support their views. The views that the Quran supports is that if somebody doesn't want to convert to Islam, then you can go and kill them.
We have 100 seconds left, and I just want you to know I'm so honored to have you on as a guest, and I'm delighted that I'm able to pick your brain and listen to clear thinking. My guest, last minute, literally, Francisco Gil White, website, HIRHOME, with 30 seconds left, Professor. Are you optimistic about the future?
No, I'm quite pessimistic. I'm predicting a genocide of Jews in Israel very, very soon. A Muslim takeover of Europe, and the collapse of the West. I'm not optimistic at all. However, if it's possible for the Israelis to wake up and kick out of power the current Israeli elite, which is obviously cooperating with the forces that wish to destroy the Jewish people, and take their country back, then we can start fighting for the West, because this is the crucial battle. The crucial battle for the West is in Israel. And if the Jewish people remains asleep, as it now is, and as it was right before World War II, then history will repeat itself and the West will once again collapse, with the difference that this time it won't get back on its feet, in my view, because the progress of Islam is too rapid and too extensive and too definite.
I'll just say this to you from that everything is logical, that Israel likely should be destroyed, overrun by its neighbors who seek to destroy it, overrun by the European Union and those who plan our destruction. There is a God of Israel who has a promise, and thank God for that promise, and that is that God will protect Israel, protect our nation, and I guess that's the miracle of the covenant. Francisco Gil White, Professor, we will follow your life on your website, HIRHOME.com. Thank you so much for joining us here on Israel National.
Thank you for having me, Dovia.
Thank you. That's all we have. This is it. We don't have, because logic, if you ask logic, it's over. What chance do we have against the enemy? None. But that's why Hashem says that I will preserve you. Israel is your land. Israel's an eternal nation, and the enemy is going down, so be not afraid. You listen to Singer, Israel National Radio. Shabbat Shalom.